dams need to come forth. And actually, there needs to be a comprehensive effort to restore salmon back up to the headwaters here, you know, so our tribal members can once again fish for those salmon and steelhead. That's a right that we intended to reserve with our treaty. And but those dams are privately owned, though they're licensed by the federal government.
Yeah.
So, but what's encouraging in this process that's been forged, there's a door that's open and a pathway to remove those four Lower Klamath River dams without federal involvement. And that's why there's the move to amend the Klamath Hydroelectric Settlement Agreement, which is a sister agreement to the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement, which is now terminated. And
wait a minute. So the Klamath Basin, the restorative has been terminated, and instead, in its place, we have, what did you say?
The Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement was terminated because it wasn't legislated by the end of 2015. But the Klamath Hydroelectric Settlement Agreement, which is a standalone agreement, though closely linked to the KBRA, mm-hmm. is now the move is to amend that agreement to keep the funding that is in play to remove the dams that was provided through through California and also by Oregon ratepayers. So there's funding that's in place to remove those dams, so there's no requirement for federal dollars to do that. So what's happening now is there's an agreement in principle that's guiding an amendment of the Klamath Hydroelectric Settlement Agreement that basically the attempt is to preserve those funds for their intended use to remove the dams.
That was Klamath Tribal Chairman Don Gentry speaking with KBOO's Chris Andre. This is KBOO Portland. Stay tuned next for Preference.
Help us celebrate the 10-year anniversary of the Confessional Radio Show with Contessa de la Luna. We have performances by Contessa de la Luna herself, Remy Fasolatido, Mike Crenshaw, and many more. We have plenty of audience participation, including human shadow puppet theater, animal impersonation contests, and prizes, prizes, prizes. And don't miss our David Bowie Kazoo tribute. All that and more, Thursday, February 11th, 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. Tickets are $10 for an entire night of music, mayhem, laughs, and surprises. All proceeds benefit KBOO Community Radio. Tickets available now in advance at brownpapertickets.com or at the door. Join us Thursday, February 11th, 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. See you there.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Clinton Street 3rd Annual Mardi Gras Festival, Tuesday, February 9th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. This annual celebration features the Les Blyke Mardi Gras films Dry Wood and Always for Pleasure, as well as food, costumes, music, and more. Again, that's the 3rd Annual Mardi Gras Fat Tuesday celebration, February 9th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Love somehow. I'm through playing with fire.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946, with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212, in Vancouver at 360-694-1234, or radiocab.net. This KBOO program has also been made in part by Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
Good evening, dear listeners. This is Preference, an Experiment in Queer Radio here on KBOO. I'm Alan Silver, your host. I'm with you one night every month. This slot, 6 to 7 on Tuesdays, is a slot for queer programming. Tune in each week of the month for a different program. We're glad to have you here on Preference. We've got a great show tonight, so stick around with us. We'll be talking with Pauline Park later, as well as Red. Red is a local sex worker advocate who's going to update us on some pending legislation in the state of Oregon that's worrisome. Right now, we're going to chat with Evan Greer. Evan, are you on the line?
I'm here. Thanks for having me on.
Wonderful. Evan, you are a touring musician. You'll be here on Valentine's Day. That's pretty groovy. You're also a trans and genderqueer activist, speaker, organizer. You're out of Boston. Tell us about that.
Sure, yeah. So I'm a queer and trans performer and writer and workshop facilitator based here in Boston, which is where I'm at right now. I'm at my house. I just put my five-year-old kid to bed. And I travel around playing music and offering workshops and training for activists from a wide variety of communities working on social justice and LGBTQ issues, and really trying to use music and popular education tools as a way of bringing people together and recognizing the connections between all different systems of oppression and ways that we can dismantle and oppose them.
Wonderful. So how long have you been playing as a musician?
I started playing music in high school. And for me, music and politics have kind of always been inextricably linked. The very first song I ever wrote was about the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan after 9/11. And I actually remember kind of writing that song and then going to some kids at my school who I knew were more involved in activism than I was and saying, hey, I wrote this song and I don't want to be a hypocrite who just thinks about this stuff but doesn't do anything about it. And that was really what got me involved in activist movements as well. And ever since then, I've been supporting myself and traveling all over the world using music as a tool to advance the important causes that I support.
And what are those causes? What are we looking at when you're out doing the work?
Yeah, I mean, I focus on a lot of different things. I mean, I think obviously right now a huge portion of the conversation deservedly is around issues of racial justice and white supremacy and dismantling it. And I think it's been super exciting to watch the Black Lives Matter movement really rise into the national and international conversation. I also focus a lot on issues on LGBTQ issues. I'm transgender and also identify as genderqueer. I'm pretty non-binary. I don't pass. and I have those experiences woven into my songs as well. And then I spent a lot of my time working on issues of climate justice. So looking at the ways that climate change and environmental issues connect with the other social justice issues that I think we all care a lot and think a lot about around race, class, gender, ability, et cetera, and asking ourselves how the ways that ecological destruction impacts marginalized communities the most. And so I've put together a lot of workshops and trainings and activism around that, and certainly have some music about it as well. But I guess what I'd also say is that a lot of my songs, I definitely write political music, but I try not to write music that's basically like lectures over guitar. I try to, find ways to tell stories and to engage with people and use art as a way to bridge those gaps and break down those walls that often keep people from being able to hear about this stuff or care about it.
Sure. So I think you're onto something with this climate discussion and intersections with racial justice. I think it's easy for folks to abstract climate change as something that happens to people outside of the country, It's something we're doing to folks overseas. That's who we should sort of export the concerns so that it's not close to home. When we see from Flint, Michigan to hundreds and hundreds of communities across this country, if we take the time to look, environmental racism as an institution in this country is something that's deeply embedded. And I think it's scary for people to take a look at that. I think it hits too close to home for a lot of folks.
Yeah, I mean, and I think it's so important that we talk about environmental issues in that way, because otherwise it really just becomes, you know, seen as something that's about polar bears and conservation and something that's really distant from the vast majority of people's lives. When the reality is, you know, I mean, for me, a formative moment for me as a climate activist was being in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina and sitting on the roof of the warehouse building that many of the volunteers I was working with were housed in, and looking at the prison, New Orleans Parish Prison, that was just a few blocks from where we were staying. And you could actually see the flood line on the prison, you know, and recognize that basically the bottom two entire floors of that prison were flooded. And it's very likely that most of those prisoners died and essentially were murdered by the system. And for me, that was a moment when it really became clear to me how these issues of climate change and environmental racism deeply were connected to other things that I cared about, like prison justice, like class and race. And I think it's so important that we talk about them that way. Otherwise, really, we're not going to be able to build an effective movement around them because we're excluding the voices and the experiences of the people who are most affected.
Exactly. Now, you're doing a show here, Valentine's Day. Pretty excited. We're chatting with Evan Greer, by the way. If you've just tuned in, she'll be here on Valentine's Day is Saturday, I think.
yeah.
At Anares, our local North Portland anarchist meeting spot. Feeling a need, I think, that we lost when Red and Black closed up shop not too long ago. Tell us about this show.
Yeah, I'm so excited to be coming back to Portland. I've always had super wonderful shows in your city. And it's going to be, yeah, like you said, at an Anares Info Shop up in North Portland. It's an all-ages show. It's a wheelchair-accessible space. Those things are both really important to me in terms of making all my shows accessible to as many people as possible. And it's going to have some great local performers. Brenna Sahatchian, who's a longtime friend of mine and a great Portland-based riot folk singer, and the Rag Shakers, who are a great band. And we're also going to be taking some time, since it is Valentine's Day, to give people materials to write quote-unquote Valentine for political prisoners, particularly for Chelsea Manning, who's a transgender whistleblower who's serving a 35-year sentence for exposing some of the U.S. government's worst abuses in Iraq and Afghanistan. And she's actually someone who I talk to on the phone on a weekly basis. So I'll also be offering kind of an update on her case and what's going on with her and giving people just a little sense of what her life is like in prison as a trans woman and as someone who's serving a sentence as a whistleblower. And, you know, so the show will have lots of fun and music and an opportunity to smile and clap and dance and sing along, but also an opportunity for people to take one very simple and concrete thing that they can do to support people, particularly queer and trans people who are in prison.
Indeed, we've heard a little bit about Chelsea's experience in prison in the news over the last year or two. Of course, it's not easy for anybody or for any trans person. And what little we hear, it sounds like Chelsea could use the support.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, Chelsea is a super amazing person, and talking to her totally has changed my life. And I think what she always wants to remind people is, I mean, obviously her experience in prison has been affected by her being trans. But she often is actually on the front lines reminding people that in some ways her experience in prison has been more positive than many trans people. She hasn't experienced direct violence from other inmates or from prison officials, for example. She faces serious harassment and other issues from the government. But I think, you know, she is actually very you know, it's important to her for people to recognize how many trans people are simply in solitary confinement for indefinite periods of time, or facing other, you know, really serious abuses while they're in prison. And I think it's amazing that she's, you know, taken her role as a high-profile whistleblower and is now using it to advocate for all trans people in prison, for regardless of what the reason that they've landed there is.
Well, thanks for giving us a sense of that. Evan, we're going to hear Never Surrender. Do you want to give a little introduction?
Yeah, sure. This is my song, Never Surrender. It's the title track off the last album that I put out. I'm actually working on a new album, finally. It's been about 5 years, which, again, coincidentally, is how old my kid is, who I often drag around on tour with me. He's been to, I think, 16 countries and 37 of the U.S. states on tour with me. He's not coming along with me to Portland this time, sorry. But yeah, this is a song about not giving up in the face of the many interconnected forms of oppression that we all face, and one that I hope gives some people some inspiration in the face of things that seem overwhelming, but that really can be taken on when we work together.
Wonderful. This is Never Surrender by Evan Greer. She'll be at Anares on Saturday for a Valentine's Day. Thanks for chatting with us, Evan.
Thanks so much for having me on. Hope to see you all at the show.
Yeah.
It's been raining for a couple of days now. My dad's pond is overflowing. The orange fish are at the back door. The toxic flood water is glowing. And we shake our heads and get in the car. Forget those things we said. Making love under the stars. I go back and forth daily about us and them and who's really to blame. But I think it's pretty clear here who has got the most to gain. From a divided up society that's terrified of honesty, and we can't discern our enemies, so we give them our complicity. They make beer and we buy it. They make cars and we drive them. They build walls and we just give in. They build boxes that we live in. They make jobs to give our days to, binaries of gender, but they won't have my surrender, no. TV. They say don't take your life so seriously. I say this is the only way that I know how to be. 'Cause we need passion, not fashion. We need food, not lawns. We need action, not factions. We need everyone here to be singing along. We need stories, not glory. We need friends, not fans. We need guitars, not rock stars. We need more than just loud drunk straight white male punk bands. So let's destroy out of love and build. As we know it, it's not
spend them together.
This is Preference Radio. I'm your host, Alan Silver, here on KBOO. That was music by Evan Greer. She'll be playing at Anaria's on Saturday night for a Valentine's show. Check it out. Next, we have Red on the phone. Red, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for joining. I've actually wanted to chat with you on the air for some time, so I'm excited for the opportunity. Red, you are a sex worker advocate here in town, and you have a number of avenues that you do this work through.
Yes.
Do you want to give us a sense of some of the work that you do?
Yeah. So I run, funded through the Campus AIDS Project, and we do two support group nights a month in town. Location in Clackamas and one in downtown, where we give out food and warm clothes and free HIV testing kits. That's actually the reason for Stroll. And then we also, you know, do like legal trainings. The next one is going to be a how to do your taxes workshop and things like that. And then I'm also the Portland rep for Swap Portland, which is it's the Portland branch of the Sex Workers Outreach Project, which is a national 501c3.
Great. Now, I think we might have had a blip and missed exactly what Stroll is.
Oh, I'm so sorry. So Stroll is an outreach and advocacy project. We the main thing that we do is hand out free HIV testing kits. It's funded by Cascade AIDS Project. And then we do that through having two support groups a month in town. One is out on 82nd on Clackamas Service Center. And then the other one is downtown at Pivot. And we also give out free food, warm clothes, jackets, and do workshops and trainings. So, like, the February one is going to be how to do your taxes with from Math LLC.
And you have a zine called Working It.
Oh, yeah, of course. I forgot about that. Yeah, I do a zine called Working It. It gets contributions from sex workers all over the world, but mostly in the U.S. and Canada. And, yeah, that's probably my favorite thing that we do. Or I do.
I just ordered an issue a couple of weeks ago, so I'm excited.
Oh, my God. I'm so behind. You should know that. I'm really sorry. I hired a personal assistant yesterday.
Wonderful. Now, you're here to specifically talk with us about Oregon House Bill 4082, HB 4082. And as I understand it, this bill passed the State House of Representatives this week. Is that right?
I believe it was, like, last Thursday, and so it's scheduled for the Senate Judiciary Committee next, I think, yeah.
And before we get into the content, the Judiciary Committee would basically make a recommendation to the larger state Senate, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Every bit of it can be a little confusing, but It's good to kind of nail that down where it is in the process. So let's talk about the content of House Bill 4082.
It's actually it's a minor change that makes a big difference. So it changes the Oregon laws on prostitution, which are already actually pretty bad. Technically, they make any, you know, harm reduction, any aid to a sex worker is technically promoting prostitution. So, you know, landlords are technically promoting prostitution, which has caused some trouble, you know, for people in the past. When landlords find out that they are, you know, renting to a sex worker, they want to cover their backs. And so the sex worker gets evicted. But what HB 4082 adds is language that specifically targets people who trade goods or services for sex, which really targets, you know, it's supposed to end trafficking. It's supposed to target traffickers. But really, the people that it's going to have an effect on are, you know, survival sex workers and people who trade sex for, you know, drugs or food or housing, which is going to be, it's going to be a lot of really vulnerable people, you know, because people with the option usually tend to go for money. So it's going to be the, you know, our youngest sex workers, young people, people without many other options who just need something right now.
So this will essentially expand the definition of who is a sex worker and who is subject to policing. Is that right?
Yeah, and it's going to be, I mean, it just opens the door to a lot more policing of vulnerable communities. You know, we don't see this used against, you know, white sex workers, indoor workers. They're really hard to get to, and so this isn't going to be effective against them. It's probably not going to be effective against traffickers, you know, people who exploit people. It's going to be easiest to use this against vulnerable people of color, trans women, you know, the most obvious targets or people who look like the obvious sex workers. So, yeah, it'll probably be a really good conduit for racial profiling, as we've seen in other cases nationwide. There were two couples of color, you know, the people in that relationship were both people of color who have been arrested so far because, you know, I think one was on an airplane, I forget, the other one was a hotel, I believe, and the workers thought that these couples were traffickers, like a man trafficking a woman just because they're brown, really, and they called the police, and of course it's just people in a relationship who happen to have dark skin.
So how can folks get involved in this particular bill? And then let's talk a bit about how folks can get more involved in their own advocacy for sex workers.
So this bill, we have a petition up. It's also really great if people want to call their senators, especially the head of the Judiciary Committee, and just tell them why, that they don't support it and they would like the senators to vote against it, and also why, you know, like, let people know and let people in positions of power know that somebody cares about what happens to sex workers. And it's also really good to add another option so that, you know, they have an idea of what would be a better alternative. And so there are some really great laws out there. RHYA is a federal law that didn't pass for the first time in its history last year because it involved the letters for the first time, LGBT. For the first time, specific funding was earmarked to go to LGBT shelters and youth shelters. And so with that addition, it didn't pass last year for the first time because of, you know, homophobia, but it's actually a really great bill. It funds shelters and day centers and drop-in programs for homeless and runaway youth. And we know that that is the population that's most at risk of being involved in an exploitative situation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for a lot of reasons, they run away from home because of abuse or because they aren't accepted. And then they're out on the streets and there isn't enough shelter for them. And so things like that, you know, suggesting or showing support for shelters and day programs and food really would make a huge difference to let people in power know that these are things that the average person supports is really important. And it gives them a constructive thing to suggest instead of supporting, you know, 4082.
In a broader sense, how can folks be good allies?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Yeah, in a broader sense, how can folks be good allies of sex workers? I think I read online that you had written that your hope is to take the sex out of sex work.
Yeah. I mean, I think that sex is a really delicate subject for a lot of people, and that's where a lot of the stigma around sex work comes from. People tend to see sex as this really intimate thing. And so, of course, anyone who is having sex with somebody who is not, you know, a life partner in a monogamous relationship, people tend to think that that must be damaging, but only for women. And so, yeah, I think that sex should be desexified. That's what I like to call it. But all demystified also works. And so if people want to support sex workers more generally, just I think talking about supporting sex workers and also talking about the ways that sex is supposed to be like this really specifically mystical, metaphysical experience for women, and then just undoing that, I think that that's really key in the longer term sense to supporting sex workers. I mean, that really showing support for vulnerable people, it overlaps. If you want to support domestic violence shelters or shelters or, you know, a higher minimum wage and affordable housing, all of this is going to come back and also help sex workers.
Those are great points. What is the climate for sex workers in terms of criminal justice in the Portland area?
It's really terrible. I have a lot to say about this. I could go probably until 9, but it's really terrible. We have a climate where the DAs are really not interested in working with sex workers. People are mostly interested in making arrests, probably for funding reasons, and so there are a lot of arrests, and you know, people want to look like they're going after traffickers because that's the hot new topic, but it actually isn't very easy to find traffickers, in part because it's not actually a widespread reality, although that's not very popular to say, and then in part because where exploitation is happening, it's happening in places that we can't see or police, like in homes or on farms. You know, it's not happening in the public eye. Which, I mean, at least police do know that. But so instead of going after really exploitative situations, people are targeting sex workers, you know, through stings and online ads. And it's unfortunate. And so, you know, sex workers can't turn to the police for help when people get assaulted or robbed or evicted. They just kind of have to roll with the punches and hope for the best.
Do you have any sense of that in the Portland area is changing for the better?
I think that Portland and Oregon have, for some reason, for whatever reason, we have a lot of people, we have a lot of anti-trafficking organizations here, and almost all of them are focused on this really, what we call like the Nordic model of, you know, decriminalizing selling sex, but then criminalizing the buyers, which hasn't worked out historically in, you know, either the Nordic area countries or in Canada. But that's what a lot of people around here are pushing. And if that goes through, it's, you know, it's not going to be good for sex workers. Mm-hmm. It's probably going to be pretty toxic.
Are there avenues through which sex workers in the area do interact positively with police in terms of advising or advocating, trying to change policy? Does that conversation exist in this area?
I don't think so. I've talked to some police, you know, through my outreach sites. There are police who come, and, you know, there are some that are more or less helpful. The ones at the outreach site tend to be really, you know, they want to do their best, but they're working in a framework that's really not very helpful, where they want to arrest all the buyers and rescue the girls and, like, send them on to some rehab project. But that doesn't actually, like, first of all, you know, don't call adult women girls. And then second of all, like, people are doing this because they need money. And so if you don't have an alternate job or source of income for them, they aren't going to leave the industry because it's about money. You know, it's about money and it's about flexibility and it's about being the easiest source of income. If people had another easy source of income, they would probably leave the industry, a lot of them. So there's a really blinkered mindset with the police that I work with around 82nd, even though I know they're trying to do good work. And then on the official end, there's just a total lack of recognition that it's about money. They say the silliest things that I am really shocked by. And so that is also limiting the ability to help sex workers and people who don't want to be in the industry and would like to get out, but either need the money or are being exploited.
Yeah. Red, thanks so much. We've been talking about sex work in general, and specifically about House Bill 4082, which has moved on to the Senate. And I suppose we'll get a new name and number, as I understand it. And can you sum up again what this bill aims to do, seeks to do?
It's trying to broaden the definition of promoting prostitution and sex work to include people who exchange goods and services for sex. It's supposed to target traffickers, but as I said earlier, it probably won't. You know, it's going to get the most vulnerable people who are trading sex for, you know, shelter or food or other things for survival. We call them survival sex workers.
All right. Thanks so much. If folks want to get involved in the conversation, chat with your senators immediately.
That would be lovely.
Yeah. And folks can look for STRL, Sex Traders Radical Outreach and Liberation Lobby.
They can, well, there's a website at strollpdx.org, and then you can get working it at Powell's, at In Other Words, and at Reading Frenzy, and on Etsy.
Wonderful. Red, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This is great.
Thanks so much. We are Preference and Experiment in Queer Radio here on KBOO. We're going to hear a little bit of music and be back with Pauline Park. I'm very excited. I'm your host, Alan. We're here on Preference and Experiment and Queer Radio. That was Alcazar, Swedish pop supergroup, with Crying at the Discotheque, one of my personal theme songs. We have here on the line Pauline Park. Welcome, Pauline.
Thank you so much, Alan.
I'm so excited to have you with us. I've had the opportunity to spend the last few days sitting online watching interviews with you, and it's been wonderful. So I'm gonna let you introduce yourself, though.
I am co-founder and chair of NIAGRA, the New York Association for Gender Rights Advocacy, and also co-founder and president of the board of directors of Queens Pride House, which is the only LGBT community center in the borough of Queens. I'm also a co-founding member of New York City Queers Against Israeli Apartheid, which is the only LGBT-specific organization in New York City that's focused on challenging Israeli occupation and apartheid. One qualification, speaking to you, delighted as I am to do so, I'm just speaking in an individual capacity and not on behalf of any organization that I'm associated with.
Thanks, Pauline. This is a particularly freighted issue for a lot of folks. I was banned from a Facebook gay Jews group this week after months of arguing with people about Palestine and Palestinian rights. I'm really surprised it took them so long to say we're really sick of hearing people criticize Israeli government's behavior. And there's a history of this, let's say, conversation. And one of the things you write about is the LGBTQ Community Center in New York City and the struggles around allowing, let's call them pro-Palestinian rights voices to use the center to hold conversation.
Yes, that's right. I wrote the only full-length account of that whole controversy, which lasted for 2 years, from February 2011 to February 2013. There was a two-year-long ban on Palestine solidarity organizing at the LGBT Community Center in Manhattan. That came to an end, fortunately, in February 2013, but not until after a very long struggle. The account is on paulinepark.com, my website. I think it was one of the most shameful episodes, really, in the history of the LGBT community here in New York, where a community center that was founded not actually to provide social services, but to be precisely a space for community organizing, including progressive and even radical community organizing, for 2 years shut down any discussion of Israel-Palestine. And we were fortunately able to overturn that ban after a two-year struggle, but it is very indicative of a larger struggle that's going on throughout the LGBT community, over Israel-Palestine, creating change in Chicago. A few weeks ago, there was a demonstration against a wider bridge, which is an organization that's focused on pinkwashing the Israeli occupation. In other words, trying to justify and generate support for the illegal Israeli occupation of Palestine by pointing to Israel's supposedly superior record on LGBT rights in order to try to divert attention away from Israel's continuing abuse of human rights of Palestinians living under the occupation in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, as well as in the Gaza Strip, which has been subjected to an illegal blockade for several years now.
That's right, and I believe that the community center, the Queer Community Center in San Francisco, also struggled with whether to allow folks to speak on these topics at all. Let us dig into a general definition of pinkwashing and why it should matter to queer folks.
Well, pinkwashing, as I said, is simply an attempt by Zionists to attempt to justify the illegal Israeli occupation of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip by diverting attention to Israel's supposedly superior record on LGBT rights. In fact, Israel's record is far from perfect, and there's a lot of discrimination and harassment directed towards LGBT people, particularly transgendered people, and particularly anyone who's not white, upper-middle-class, Jewish, and an Israeli citizen living in North Tel Aviv. In any case, no matter how good Israel's record on LGBT rights is, or how bad the record of other states in the region may be on LGBT rights, that actually can't possibly justify the violation of the human rights of all Palestinians living in the occupied territories, not to mention the institutionalized discrimination against Palestinian citizens of the State of Israel. After all, if you thought through that logic, that would mean that countries such as Jamaica, Nigeria, Russia should be subjected to permanent military, foreign military occupation, because they also have really bad records on LGBT issues. Human rights should be human rights for all, and that includes all people, regardless of whether they're LGBT or not. But it's an issue that should be of concern to LGBT people, because there are LGBT queer Palestinians who are living under this illegal occupation, who get no special rights or privileges for being LGBT. There's this really extraordinary myth that's being circulated by Zionists that says that Israel and Tel Aviv in particular are havens, safe havens for gay Palestinians who flee the supposedly monolithically homophobic West Bank and Palestinian society, for gay bars in Tel Aviv. That doesn't happen. Israel does not recognize non-Jewish political asylees, candidates for political asylum. If you are LGBT and you do actually make your way across the Green Line into Israel, you will be sent back. You may actually be blackmailed into becoming an informant or a collaborator, which would place you in an extremely dangerous position going back into the West Bank. So the reality is very, very far from what Zionist pinkwashing groups such as the Wider Bridge are attempting to portray. And LGBT people who are fighting for our rights here in this country, and that struggle clearly is not over despite the win on marriage equality last year, we should support rights, human rights for all, including Palestinians, including, of course, LGBT Palestinians who are denied human rights just as their non-LGBT Palestinian brethren and sistren are in the occupied territories.
Indeed. And this this pinkwashing campaign, which is something the Israeli government promotes, we know, and they're actively engaged in it around the world, particularly in, we can see it best in the U.S., where Israel sponsors film festivals, for example, to help make it easier for Israeli films to be shown. That's queer film festivals, and so on and so on. This campaign not only turns queer folks in Israel into props, into propaganda pieces, but all queer folks in Muslim countries are drafted into this against their will. Whatever their situations, whatever their needs are, they become the shadow to Israel's supposed liberal democracy.
Yes, precisely. And the reality is that Israel is becoming less liberal and less of a democracy by the day. Law after law being enacted by the Israeli Knesset, the Israeli parliament, that is suppressing free speech and freedom of expression. It is now essentially illegal for any Israeli to advocate boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel because of its human rights record. Under civil law, you can be sued, and the penalties basically could bankrupt you. Israel is also pursuing similar laws abroad. In France, for example, it is a criminal act to advocate for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against apartheid Israel. And the French state is now actually prosecuting people. It has already prosecuted three human rights activists simply for advocating BDS, not taking any action. But if you publicly advocate for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against apartheid Israel, that is in fact a criminal act. Here in New York, the state Senate just passed a bill that is now being considered by the state assembly that would prohibit any organization from seeking a contract, including grants, from the state of New York that publicly advocates boycott, divestment, or sanctions, not only against Israel, but against a whole host of countries, many of which have extremely bad human rights records. For example, the right-wing governments in Poland and Hungary and Turkey, as well as South Korea. And so the movement to suppress BDS is a movement to suppress freedom of speech, and in fact, a movement to suppress democracy, both in Israel and abroad, including here in the U.S., which belies the whole Zionist claim that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. In fact, it's not. Tunisia has emerged from the Arab Spring as a vibrant democracy, and despite the challenges facing Tunisian democracy, is actually going in the right direction, whereas Israel is moving in the wrong direction, with more and more laws, regulations, and government actions that are prohibiting and undermining freedom of speech and freedom of assembly, including for Jewish citizens of Israel, not to mention Palestinian citizens of Israel. Palestinians living in the occupied territories have no rights.
And New York is one of six American states, as I understand it, considering sanctions on companies that participate in boycott.
Yes. There are laws being considered, I believe, in Maryland and Illinois and Pennsylvania and other states. This is a very, very dangerous trend. If you think about South Africa, what is it that brought about the end of apartheid in South Africa? BDS. It took 35 years, but it was the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement that really brought about a fundamental change in South Africa. That same set of tools is needed to bring about an end to the apartheid regime in occupied Palestine.
No.
And I might mention, by the way, that Nelson Mandela was branded a terrorist by the U.S. government, the British government, and several other governments of Western democracies. And I might also mention that Israel was the staunchest ally of apartheid South Africa, and the Israeli government actually helped the apartheid South African regime to develop nuclear weapons capacity.
Now, I think one thing that folks can do, to counter all of this, is to let the voices of queer folks in Palestine or in Muslim countries help give them voice to tell their stories, insofar as they're willing and able to do so. I think that would be a big step.
That's exactly right, Alan. There are LGBT queer organizations in Israel, Palestine. I was on the first U.S. delegation tour, LGBTQ delegation tour to Palestine back in January 2012, and we met with LGBT and non-LGBT groups both in Israel and in occupied Palestine. Al-Qas, which is based in Ramallah, is the leading LGBT queer Palestinian rights group. Aswad is based in Haifa on the Israeli side of the Green Line, which is an organization for lesbians, bisexual women, and transgendered people. And PQBDS is Palestinian Queers for Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. All three of them have called on LGBT individuals and groups and organizations outside of Israel to support BDS. And so, despite the fact that Zionists are always saying that pinkwashing groups like A Wider Bridge are just trying to foster dialogue, which they're not, the best way to help queer Palestinians is actually to support LGBT queer Palestinian groups. And you can actually do that now through a fiscal conduit. You can actually directly financially support Al-Qas. You can also support Aswad in Haifa. And so the best thing that you can do is directly support these groups and also support BDS. That's what Palestinians, both queer and non-queer, are calling for since 2005, when Palestinian civil society first issued a call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions aimed at apartheid Israel.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Preference, a queer experiment on radio. I'm your host, Alan, and I'm chatting with Pauline Park. Pauline, you've mentioned A Wider Bridge a couple of times. This is an organization which seeks to make links between queers around the world and Israelis.
Yes, and the interesting thing about it is the reception that they held at Creating Change at the Hilton Chicago a few weeks ago was supposedly about dialogue. They brought in Jerusalem Open House, which is an organization that has a legitimate track record of being open to queer Palestinians as well as queer Israelis. But the reality was, this was a reception, this was an event held by a wider bridge, and the primary purpose was to try to generate support for the apartheid regime in occupied Palestine. Arthur Slepian, who is the executive director, told a lot of untruths after the demonstration. I'm also fairly convinced that it was a wider bridge that called the Chicago Police Department to intervene. And given the record of the Chicago PD, which murdered Laquan McDonald, calling the cops on demonstrators, there were, by different estimates, between 200 and 500 demonstrators who were protesting this pinkwashing reception at the Chicago Hilton as part of creating change. Many of them were people of color, many of them young people of color. So when you call the cops on youth of color, given that the attendees at the reception were all white, and that the demonstration was very significantly, probably over half people of color, many of them young people, that is a very, very disturbing act, given the record of the Chicago Police Department in the murder of Laquan McDonald, also given the fact that the mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, is an arch Zionist. So looking at the larger context of this, and having spoken with people who were directly involved in the protest, having seen the videos for myself, even though I didn't actually attend Creating Change this year, it's pretty clear to me that Arthur Slepian, a wider bridge, and his confederates have really quite deliberately misled the public as to what happened. It was not in any way anti-Semitic. There was nothing anti-Jewish about the protest. In fact, there was significant Jewish participation in the demonstration, which is something that a wider bridge and its confederates are trying to suppress. It was a progressive protest against the pinkwashing of Israeli occupation and apartheid.
To give a little background, Creating Change is the annual National Gay and Lesbian Task Force Conference. There was another presentation scheduled by ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, at the conference this year, and Black Lives Matter and other folks stood up and said, "We don't want that. Please cancel it." It was canceled.
Yes. It's disturbing enough that the task force invited ICE. They backed down when they were confronted by activists who pointed out how unsafe that made them. Sue Hyde, who's the director of Creating Change, actually canceled the pinkwashing reception, but then under pressure from a wider bridge and various Zionist organizations, the executive director, Ray Carey, reversed position and reinstated the scheduling of the reception, which actually created the dangerous situation precisely because the reception was held in this ballroom just off this very narrow corridor, and to be perfectly frank, the task force completely mismanaged that whole situation. And the fact that a wider bridge would demand that the hotel staff call the Chicago police on a peaceful demonstration made the situation dangerous for the demonstrators, many of whom were young people of color. It was a disgraceful act. Most of what I've read, I would say 90% of what I've read, accounts and critiques of the episode from Zionists, has been misleading, if not downright false. And the truth is very, very far from what Arthur Slepian and the wider bridge and their confederates are presenting it as being.
This isn't just a question, of course, of whether or not folks feel solidarity with Palestinians. It's also a question of what we want queer activism and our queer movement to be. We just have about a minute left, Pauline. Can you speak to that?
I think it's a question of whether the LGBT community and movement want to be aligned with an apartheid regime enforcing an illegal occupation, or whether we want the LGBT community and movement defined as a broad-based pursuit of social justice and of human rights for all. That's what's at stake, whether it's a movement that's inclusive of people of color, including Palestinians, Arabs, Muslims, progressive Jewish Americans, who are seeking social change and social justice, or whether we have a movement that's basically dominated by wealth and power and by a Zionist machine that is attempting to pinkwash the illegal Israeli occupation of Palestine. I think the stakes are very high.
Pauline, thanks so much for chatting with us. This is a pinkwashing is a topic we've discussed before in preference, and I think we'll be coming back to it along with other aspects of our conversation tonight. Thanks so much to you.
Thank you so much for the invitation, Jan. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Thanks also to Red and Evan Greer, who were with us tonight. David, for keeping things moving from the control room. And thanks to you, our listeners. Hard Knock Radio is up next. This has been Preference.
Good evening, you are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, we have Hard Knock Radio. Look at your weather tonight. It's patchy fog with a low of 43. Tomorrow, we're looking at a slight chance of rain with a high of 56. And then tomorrow night, a 30% chance of rain with a low of